Oh, and we have a lot of online people too. That's
Do
great.
Yeah, this is a little bit.
So Lisa is in her final year of her PhD. She's done a lot of really interesting work in machine learning, but especially in interpretability. She has looked in, she's done some interesting work having to do with aleatoric and epistemic uncertainty. And she's done other work looking at other aspects of interpretability, but the work that I asked her to come and talk about today, which I'm anticipating you'll talk about, but of course you're free to talk about anything, Lisa, is she did this really, really interesting work trying to extract new human new knowledge unknown previously unknown to humans about chess from the AlphaZero chess system. And so in doing that work, she had to wrestle with a bunch of new types of problems. And I thought it was just so fascinating. I wanted to hear talk a little bit about it. So welcome, Lisa. The floor is yours. Do you want to see if your sh screen sharing works?
Yeah, that sounds great. Thank you so much for having me. Okay. I think. Can you see just sort of my slides?
Yeah.
Yes, something's wrong with our projector on our side. So let me take a second here. Oh, it's for some reason it's small. Maybe your screen is,
Cool.
oh, maybe you're sharing a window that's not the same aspect ratio as ours or something like that.
Wait,
So
let me
if you make it
fix.
wider, it'll fill up more of our screen.
Me. See. Okay.
Oh, this, oh, this, oh, this, oh, so there it is. Yeah. There's the keyboard. Try. And so,
Sorry, I don't know what's happening on my end.
it's okay. You can
Oh,
try
there
again. So I think that if you what you did f before was fine, but maybe I'll ask you to make the window wider
we go. Yeah, it
instead
is
of smaller.
looking better now.
Give me a second for it to sync up with Zoom. Let's see. It says Lisa has started screen sharing, and
Oh,
oh, look, it's
yes.
beautiful.
Yep.
It's totally full screen.
Awesome. Okay. Let me just, okay. Great. I just want to see if I can get my notes up too, but otherwise I will do it without my notes.
We're a friendly audience. Don't worry. Oh, yeah. You show up, Chris.
Oh, sure.
What is it that you're looking for?
To look to see your face.
Oh, yeah.
Just a single, yeah.
Okay.
Oh,
Oh,
maybe. Oh,
should
shoot.
we show
Oh,
it on
because we
the
were
headphones?
speaking.
Yeah.
Oh,
No, that was a bad
yeah.
choice. Now,
Can you minimize? Oh,
see,
wait, but
see
now
that
we.
doesn't
In the
work.
button on the right. The
Oh,
button on
switch
the
to
right.
switch to shared
Switch
content.
to
What, where
shared
is that?
settings.
Oh,
Yeah.
right there. Oh, so
Ah.
fancy. You guys are like Zoom masters. Okay, I think we've got everything set up on our side too, Lisa. So whenever you're ready.
Okay, great. Well, thank you so much for having me. I'm really excited to talk to you about, oh, sorry, this is the first slide, about my research. So maybe as a very brief introduction, I'm a final year PhD student at the University of Oxford. I'm currently visiting the Coco SciLab here in Princeton with Tom Griffiths. And yeah, I'm excited to talk to you about my work. If you have any questions, please feel free to just jump in and interrupt me. I probably won't be able to see the chat, or I can't at the moment, so just shout out any questions you have. All right. So maybe before I dive right into the project, I want to talk a little bit about the long-term vision that we had when we were doing this project. And so basically, our idea is that we want to use AI to create a positive impact. And more specifically, we wanted to push, sorry, the frontier of human knowledge by leveraging interpretability tools for knowledge discovery and to unlock new model capabilities in a safe and responsible way. And that was sort of the underlying idea in this project. So we want to find new human knowledge, or new knowledge, sorry, that we could teach to humans. So the project that I'm going to specifically be talking to you about is this paper that we wrote called Bridging the Human AI Knowledge Gap, Concept Discovery and Transfer in AlphaZero.
Hopefully that works.
Sorry, just frozen on our end, but I don't think it's a you.
I think it'll be okay. There was just a hiccup for 2 seconds, yeah. But you're back online.
Okay. So this is a project that I was really lucky to do with a lot of incredible collaborators and mentors, namely Nanad, Tom.
Oh no. Is this going to be chronic?
Maybe just everyone get off your computers.
On my end, the connection is fine, by the way.
It's
on us.
It's ours is unstable.
Everyone turn off the internet.
Oh no. What to do?
We could probably just use one of our laptops to just hear the audio. And that's
fine. Why don't you continue on, Lisa, and we'll see if this connection works.
Actually, do you mind if I just fix one thing on my screen?
Sure, go ahead.
Is it okay from your end?
Looks good. You're in a window now, but so it's a little smaller, but it's fine.
All right. So maybe to sort of describe sort of the way that we think about this project. So if you look at this circle, this is sort of circle represents what we as humans know. And then you can think of a second circle as representing what machines know. And so there may be some knowledge that humans know, but machines don't know, which is represented on the left, which is H minus M. Then there's knowledge that humans and machines have in common, which is this middle, so M intersect H. And then there's some knowledge that's unique to machines, which is on the right side, which is shaded in. And so previous work has focused on the intersection between the two. So this is when we ask things like, you know, which known concepts does the model encode? So this happens very often in probing and is what the previous paper focused on. And in this work, what we try to do is we want to target M minus H. So what does the system know that we as humans might not know yet? So in our work, we want to find concepts in M minus H and teach them to humans. And we decide to do this in the domain of chess. So we think that the domain of chess is the ideal sort of domain to pursue this goal for a couple of reasons. The first one is that humans have extensively analyzed chess for a long time, which means that we have a well-defined sort of human knowledge space. So this, we have a lot of insight into the circle H. The second thing is that AI systems have performed at a superhuman level for a very long time, which would suggest that they may have knowledge that we don't have. And the third thing is that the ground truth evaluation is much easier in the domain of chess, right? So if you compare it, for example, to the domain of like medicine or science, where if we find something, we may need to perform wet lab experiments, it's a lot easier here. For example, to simulate games to find the ground truth outcome. So maybe before I go into this, as a quick question, who here knows how AlphaZero works or has read the paper or?
Maybe 10%.
10%, okay. Good. Then I'll give a brief overview. So I'll start with a bit of a technical overview, a very, very short one, and then I'll go into the way that I kind of think that it plays chess. And so AlphaZero, as sort of like a method, it has two main components. It has a policy value network. And essentially what that does is it takes as input a chess position, and then it'll output two different things. The first thing is the probability distribution over the next action. So this is kind of similar to like an LLM, right? Like you have like a probability distribution over the tokens. It's the same here. It's like a probability distribution over the moves. And then the other thing that it outputs is a value, which is an estimate of whether it thinks that white is better, or whether things have black is better, or whether it's equal. So that's the first component, the policy value network. And the second thing is that it also uses a search algorithm, Monte Carlo tree search, which it uses to select the move which it wants to play. Now, when I think about AlphaZero, I think about it a little bit as follows. So I used to play chess professionally, and so I don't know, I think it kind of, I like to think of it like in how it relates to how humans play chess. And so when I look at a chess position, like the one that's shown here, and maybe actually before I continue, how many people play chess?
Maybe 50%.
Okay, that's quite some. Right, so when I look at this position, I first, you know, you can't calculate all possible moves, that's impossible. And for those of you who play chess, black is human. So instead, what I do is I'd say like, okay, you know, what are the most important aspects of the position? And here I might be like, okay, it's a very early stage position, so I want to develop as many pieces as I can. I might think a little bit about like, you know, what are the structural weaknesses? Where do I have more space? What is sort of my long-term plan? But there are sort of these high-level features that you extract, and that's the first step that humans do. And you can think of AlphaZero doing roughly the same, because it takes a position and it passes it through the policy value network, which is also essentially extracting these features. So next, as humans, what we'll do is we'll, based off of these features, try to come up with a couple of moves. So here is black to move for the chess players. We might do something like bishop d7, try to develop the pieces. We might castle, bring our king into safety. Or we might think of like slightly more creative moves like rook g8, which happens to be the best move here. And AlphaZero essentially does the same, right? So it's like extracting these features in the policy value network. And then what it does is it basically creates sort of, you know, this probability distribution over moves, but there will be usually a couple of moves which have a lot of mass on it. So basically there are a couple of moves that it thinks are the most interesting. And then after it's done that, what it does is it essentially starts calculating, and we do the same as humans. So when we think about a couple of moves and which one we want to play, we'll kind of go through this loop of saying like, okay, if I play this move, what is my opponent's best response? What am I going to respond to that? And you'll do it sort of in the same way that's described here. And AlphaZero does the same. So once it's sort of selected these moves, it thinks that it's most interesting to calculate, it'll use MCTS to actually find which move it wants to play and calculate the next best continuation. Are there any questions so far? Then I'll move on. So now moving on to our work, there's sort of four main components that I'd like to talk about. So I'm gonna start with talking about what is a concept. Then I'll go into how do we find concepts, and then how do we find concepts in the space M minus H, so concepts that are unique to AlphaZero that humans may not know yet. And then how do we, or can we teach these concepts to humans? We'll start off with what is a concept. So there are several possible definitions of a concept. Like in the literature, you'll see things like, you know, they're human understandable high level features, or for example, it's an abstract idea. In our work, we define a concept as a unit of knowledge. And there's sort of two main aspects to this definition. So the first one is that it is useful. So it's something, for example, that can be used to solve a task. So if you think about this more generally, like if you have the concept of a beak, we can use this idea of a beak to identify birds. Or for example, in the context of chess, we have the concept of material, where material is the aggregate value of the pieces. And we can use this, for example, to determine whether or not we want to exchange certain pieces. And the second aspect of this definition is that there's sort of this notion of minimality, so that a concept should be concise and that irrelevant information should be removed. So again, if we think about chess, we could have a concept that is space and time and material. You could add on a lot of other things. And while all three of these things, for example, are useful, it's a lot easier for humans to learn one of these things as opposed to all three at the same time. And so the idea here is to sort of break down the knowledge into a form that makes it easier to understand, and so as concise as possible. So now that we have a definition, I'll start explaining how we sort of use that definition to actually find concepts. So in order to actually translate our definition into something that we can, you know, write up for formulate using math, we need to make two main assumptions. So the first assumption that we make is that concepts are linearly encoded in the latent space of the policy value network. So the previous work that I'd referred to way in the beginning they'd actually already shown that they could find concepts in sort of the policy value network. And when I say latent space, I just mean, you know, if you take the layers and you take the post-activation representations, those are the ones that I mean. And the second sort of core assumption here is that we make a linearity assumption, right? But this is one that's commonly made in our field and has shown some success in extracting concepts. You could also make other assumptions on the structure, but we stick with this one here. And the second assumption that we make sort of builds on this first one. So we assume that a concept can be represented as a vector. And the second assumption that we make is that the more relevant a concept is for a position, the smaller the cosine distance to the latent representation of that position. So this will come up later, but it's important for both in the way that we find concepts, but also finding examples of the concept. Now, based off of these two assumptions, we can actually formulate concept discovery as a convex optimization problem. So if you remember our definition, we had that a concept is minimal. And so we can achieve this by trying to find a concept that is represented as a sparse vector, which we'll do using the objective of the convex optimization problem. And we also want that a concept is useful, right? That it's something that we can use to solve a task. And we'll do this using the constraints. So sort of the toy formulation looks something like this, right? So we want to minimize the norm of this vector subject to some constraints. Now the question is, how do we get these constraints, right? How do we write constraints to ensure that this concept is actually something that's useful? So the idea is sort of as follows. We say, okay, a concept is something that, you know, motivates a plan. So for example, in this position, which we also saw before, you know, there was like a structural weakness. And we can think of this sort of structural weakness induced in White's position as something that motivates us to choose a certain plan. So on the right-hand side is basically sort of a very basic tree showing the calculations that you might make. And the green sort of, you know, the moves that are circled in green show a rollout, which the agent may select in this position. But what's also important about this rollout is that the reason we do it is because of the structural weakness. So we want to sort of leverage this concept in the position, whereas that a rollout which we don't choose may not actually leverage this concept. So maybe as a brief summary, the idea is that a concept is present in the rollout that we choose, and it's not present or it's not leveraged in the rollout that we don't choose. And so using that idea, we can formulate the convex optimization formulation. And so what we simply do is we require that the concept is more aligned with the latent representations of the positions in the green rollout than it is in the red rollout. And so for every concept that we try to find, we will formulate or sort of create one of these convex optimization problems. And essentially all we need is actually an input position. And after that, what we do is we run Monte Carlo tree search to get these rollouts, which we need to find the vector.
So can I ask, a concept is, so does that mean a concept is specific to a given board position?
That's a great question. So it can be, but we try to find concepts that aren't. And so this comes up later. We have a mechanism that basically filters the concepts to ones that generalize across different board positions. To generalize across different board positions, you can actually just combine basically these constraints and then aggregate them over different positions and say, oh, this vector is relevant in this sequence, and sort of add those constraints and then just add more constraints for the next board position you want it to be relevant for, if that makes sense.
Yeah, so I guess, so locally a concept might only be relevant to a subsequence of the upcoming moves for, like, the concept might no longer be relevant after 10 more moves or something like that. Is that right? But it might be relevant for this, but yeah, and then eventually, hopefully you're finding concepts that are relevant for a lot of different situations.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And sort of like, I don't know. I think about like the parallels between chess and math, and sometimes I find it an intuitive comparison, but like if the concept is sort of like taking derivatives or something like that. So you have sort of this way of taking derivatives, like you have like certain rules in taking derivatives, like for example for exponents, and those are the ones that might be sort of more locally applicable to specific problems. But you also have sort of the more general strategies, and I think so you could find both with ours. And there's a metric that comes up later, which allows us to filter the ones that are more generally applicable.
Thanks. What is the Z here? Is Z here the thing that kind of like results in that specific rollout in the MCTS tree?
Yeah, thank you. That's a great question. Sorry, I jumped off that very briefly. But Z is essentially just the latent representation of the position in that rollout. So, like for example, ZTL is the latent representation of the selected sort of the position in the selected rollout at time t at a given layer L.
But all the rollouts are from the same board position, right? Like given a board position, what is the next move of the model? So what is the Z actually?
Oh yeah, no, sorry. This is a great question. So basically, maybe this is so like you start in this position, right? And then you have two moves that you could play. So one of them is Rook G8 and one of them is castle. The moves don't matter, but you end up in different states. And so
Oh,
basically for these
okay.
different states, we'll like find the latent representation corresponding to these different states and then contrast them.
Oh, okay. Cool. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you for your question.
And is there a way that you are finding the values for these states? Like how do you make sure that one is a positive state and one is a negative state?
Yeah, this is a great question. So what we do is when we find like what we'll call the optimal trajectory and the suboptimal trajectory, because we ran Monte Carlo, sorry, tree search, we have a couple of statistics that we get back. So we have what, for example, the estimated value is if we take these different trajectories, and that's one of the things that we leverage. So we ensure that the value is different between these two trajectories. Another
Yes.
statistic that you also have is number of times it was calculated, or sort of alpha zero looked at this position during its calculations, which also gives some insight. But basically, we ensure that the green one is always like the value is significantly or is different than the red one.
Another question to the minimality constraint. You take the L1 norm. And this kind of assumes that like the directions or interpretable concepts are axis aligned. So multiple concepts that involve multiple directions, multiple axes are bigger or like less minimal than ones that are axis aligned. Why is that? Why do you penalize the axis alignment? Is there some like privileged basis that makes you think should be sparse? So, oh, wait, you. I'm just gonna say the word sparse. It, like, why the sparsity, assumption? Is that basically what you're asking? Yeah.
That is a good question. I think that's an assumption. I think given more time, I would have actually liked to see what happens if we, for example, also consider different norms. So I think this is a valid question. It's like it's a design choice that we made that limited it. I do think so. Part of the reason is that like in the architecture, it kind of corresponds to a chessboard. So there is like an 8x8 sort of, or chess is like an 8x8 board, and this is sort of continued throughout the network. And so when you sort of make this assumption, you're sort of saying like it focuses on certain squares or subparts of the board, which is something that chess players do. But yeah, so it is sort of like, yeah, I would have liked to play with the L2 norm if I'm being very honest. I think that that's a great point. But I think in the context of chess, the L1 norm also makes sense because you do get sort of these local patterns that you're picking up on.
Thank you.
Are there more questions?
One more question. So is the probability for the policy, like, does it usually like align with the value that's predicted? So like, does a higher value give you a higher probability usually?
Oh, right. Okay. So the probability is the probability distribution over moves. So, like, for example, here, I think, like, Rook G8, it might give like I don't know, 0.22 and so on. And so like, basically that's just the probability that it, like a prior probability that assigns to the move, or at least that's the way I think about it. And it is of course sort of related to the value because it's going to try to suggest moves that it thinks are better. And so you would hope that the higher the probability assigned to this move, the better the value is, or the better the move actually is, so the better the estimated value. But I think it's not necessarily always the case, right? So sometimes what you'll do is you'll think a move might be an interesting move, but once you calculate it, you realize that there's a concrete reason that it's a wrong move. And so the value doesn't correspond to the probability. So there's a difference there, but there is also a relationship between the two. Sorry, this is not the best answer or the most clear answer. So please tell me if you have questions. Because the value is sort of, it's estimated based off of the sort of final board position, which takes into account the probability as well, because the probability determines the probability that you execute a move. So there's this weird relationship between the two.
I have one more question. So I'm not sure if I just missed it, but the probability distribution over next moves that it picks, are all of those vectors the same size every time? So I guess, would there just be a lot of zeros for moves that are illegal, or how do you deal with like illegal moves? Are those like elements of that vector, or does the size of the vector change depending on how many legal moves there are?
Yeah, so this is a great question. So the way that it's implemented, it outputs it over all possible moves, and then I think filters out illegal moves and then readjusts the probability. So you can think of it as zeros for legal moves.
Okay.
Are there more questions? Okay, I'll continue then, but please feel free to continue asking questions. They're great. Okay. So we sort of got into the convex optimization formalization. And yeah, because we are introducing a new method, one of our first steps has to be how well it works. This isn't a main part of the talk. If there is a specific aspect that you're interested in, do let me know, because then I can go over it in a little bit more detail. But we evaluated our method in the supervised setting. So in chess, because it's really sort of well analyzed by humans, what we have is a lot of data sets, and specifically data sets corresponding to concepts. And so what we did, for example, is we tested three different things. The first one is we could find new positions which weren't used in the convex optimization formula that contain the concept. And the way that we evaluated this is basically you can find a set of positions that contain a concept because we have sort of these supervised data sets. And then you can see if you find a vector using a subset of those positions, can you identify the ones that aren't in the set? The next thing that we looked into is whether or not we could influence the model behavior using the concept vectors. So essentially what this meant is if you took the position and then you encoded it, and then you nudge the hidden state in the direction of the concept, could we influence the behavior or the move that it selected? And the way that we evaluated this is we looked at a chess puzzle set. So for example, if you have, you know, a set of positions where the optimal move corresponds to, for example, creating more space or obtaining more space, then what we would do is we would take the position, we'd sort of pass it through the network, and then we'd amplify the space concept vector and then see whether or not alpha zero's move changed. And what we found is that, like, in terms of solving these problems, it got sort of 5 to 10% better if we nudge the embedding in the direction of the concept that was used or should be used to solve the position. And the last thing that we did is we evaluated our approach on data efficiency. So we found concept vectors using different numbers of positions. And then we looked at how the quality of the concept vector changed. And we found that we could find relatively high quality concept vectors using only like 10 to 25 position pairs. So there's more details on this in the paper. But also just for time, I will continue because our paper is actually about trying to find new concepts, so sort of more in the unsupervised setting. So far what we've done is we've formulated concept discovery as a convex optimization problem, and we verified that our method works sort of well in the supervised setting. Next, our question is, okay, how do we sort of adapt this method or change it, not change it, but how do we use it in an unsupervised way? So recall our formulation, there were two parts. So what we really wanted to do here, or what we really needed to do, is find positions and then run MCTS. The question, for example, is how do you find these positions? Well, here what we did is we leveraged that AlphaZero uses self-play. So we had sort of two main steps. We first created a lot of self-play games from AlphaZero. And to do that, we just simulated a set of games. And to obtain a diverse set of games, we just sampled different starting positions from the chess encyclopedia of openings. And then to filter the positions, to find positions that might be interesting to look for concepts for, we actually leveraged AlphaZero's training history. So what we essentially did is we took a weaker version of AlphaZero, which was around 80 ELO points weaker than the strongest version, and the strongest version of AlphaZero. And then for every single position, we said, okay, are they going to play the same move? And we also checked that, you know, if they play different moves, are they sort of meaningfully different in the sense of that they lead to a different evaluation? So if through, for every single self-play game, we formed sort of this filter, and then we found 4,000 positions, which we then started to use to find concepts. So now we've sort of adapted the approach so that we can use it in an unsupervised way.
I'm curious how severe that filter was. Do you have a sense for, you ended up with 4,000 positions out of, is that like 1%?
I don't know. It is in the paper. So this, I think it is a pretty strict filter. Also because the two versions of AlphaZero that we took were relatively similar already. And I think we could have taken a weaker version. So maybe for context, they're both already like very far into superhuman level.
Cool.
But so this was a pretty strict filter. I think the filters that are coming up are also quite strict.
Cool.
Okay. So we have our unsupervised approach. So the next question is, how do we ensure that concepts are in M minus H? So if you recall our definition of concept, we wanted a concept to be useful so that it can be used to solve a task. We wanted it to be minimal. And we add in two new aspects that we care about to find new concepts. So the first one is that we want our concept to be novel. We want it to be in M minus H. And we also want it to be teachable. So we want it to be so that we can teach the concept to a new agent or human. And this sort of relates back to an earlier question, right? Of is a strategy only or the concept only applicable to one position? And teachability sort of ensures that it's something that could be more broadly applied. So let's first talk about novelty. So if you recall this diagram from like way before, this is kind of how I like to think about it. Like we want to find something that's in the shaded area, so M minus H. And the way that we go about it is pretty simple. We first want to kind of estimate the circle H, then we want to estimate M, and then basically we try to find something that's more in M minus H, so it's more aligned with M than it is with the space H. And so how do we go about this? Well, essentially, first what we do is we estimate the space M and H. So for example, to estimate M, what we did is we took AlphaZero's games, and then for every single position, we obtained the latent representation. And then we take all of these latent representations and we stack it into a matrix. So the matrix is all the positions by the latent dimension. And then we just take the spectral decomposition of that matrix to find the basis vectors. And you can kind of think about these vectors as like, you know, the, like the units of knowledge of like AlphaZero, or sort of like the language of AlphaZero. And we do the exact same for humans games. And after we've done that, for every single concept, we estimate whether or not that concept can be better reconstructed using the basis vectors of AlphaZero's games or human games. So basically, a sort of intuitive way to think about it is like, if we have this concept, can we better explain it sort of using the language of AlphaZero or the language of humans, where with here, the vocabulary are the basis vectors. And so we filter a lot of the concepts based off of novelty. And the second thing that we also cared about.
So to me, that's interesting because it's really just your concept here is just static board positions. There's no tree search here at all in this like human concepts, right? So you're not necessarily restricting it to concepts that humans might be trying to maximize or that machines are trying to maximize in either of these, right? Or am I missing something?
No, that's a great question. So the novelty metric So the novelty metric just sort of looks at like the spaces where the concepts lie in, but the concepts when they originally found were based off of more sort of dynamic states. So they are like based off of a rule up.
So they are. So there's a whole pipeline here where you're collecting a whole set of H concepts using this sort of tree search thing. So it's not like I see. So you have like 4,000 board states from your synthetic case. You have some number of thousand human games, and each one of those things corresponds to a concept vector. Is that right, or am I getting the number wrong?
So almost. So we have basically 4,000 positions for which we're going to look for concepts in.
Yep.
And then so we found 4,000 vectors, and then after we found those 4,000 vectors, we say like, if we look at these vectors, do we think that they're like, is it sort of like a general vector, like a general idea that we are as humans already know or not? And then what we do is for a different, like just a very large set of alpha zeros games and a very large set of human games, we say like, is this vector sort of more aligned with alpha zeros games or is it more aligned with human games?
I see. Does it just show up in the game? So the basis that you're reconstructing it in doesn't have anything to do with tree search, right? The basis is just board states.
Yes.
I see. So this is like a vector that's more typical of that distribution.
Yes.
I see.
So is the assumption kind of like when you get the board states, the concept is already kind of like baked in. So you should be able to extract that with the basis vectors of the board states.
Can you say it louder?
Sure. So you get the concept vectors with the MCTS, and when you get the board states from maybe the middle of the layer, is the assumption kind of like the concept is already in the board's latent? So you are expecting to extract that concept when you extract that concept with the basis of the board state?
Yeah, so this is a great question. So in our paper, we actually differentiate between two different types of concepts. So the one that you're describing, we call static concepts. So those are the ones that are already existing sort of in the position. So they're sort of, they're there versus what we call dynamic concepts. So the dynamic concepts are the ones that would arise. And so they wouldn't necessarily be in the original state, but they will come at some point, like in the rollout. So for example, here, like they might appear at t equals 3 or t equals 2, but they might not necessarily be there at t equals 0 or t equals 1 yet. And this also, if you look at the constraint, it's not a strict inequality. So equality is allowed. So it's allowed to, for example, in the beginning, not be there in both in the pairs of positions, but it can just arise later in one setting, but not the other one.
So if there is a dynamic concept that arises at like t is equal to 3, you have no way of extracting that at t equal to 0, right?
Actually, we would extract it with this, right? Because if you think about the constraints, if it's not there at t equals 2, t equals 1, t equals 0, that doesn't matter because as long as it's not... in like, let's say the suboptimal rollout or the red rollout, because then you have sort of equality, right? It's like 0 versus 0. Like it's not there. And that continues.
Yeah, I understand that you can extract it with this, but you can't extract it when you do the SVD, when you actually work with the basis vectors. Because it only focuses on the current board state, not from the future.
Yeah, and so that is true, but what we would hope is that because we just sample a very, very large number of positions, that it would appear in one of them. But you are correct, that is like a shortcoming.
Oh, okay, cool. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
I would also have like a really short question. Sorry. You embed the human games also using AlphaGo's network.
Yeah.
Okay.
That's it. So when you was there a question that was continuing?
Oh, maybe I must have. Well, no, I just had another question, so you go first.
I think someone from the Zoom was asking, and then I interrupted.
Oh,
oh no, I think that's resolved.
That was all.
Mm-hmm.
So if you are taking the embeddings of the human games from the network,
mm-hmm.
would that really give the entire edge space, or is it just giving the intersection of H and M? Because we are just collecting the knowledge of what the model thinks the human game is giving. So do you think it's mostly coming from the intersection?
Yeah, I think that's a... yeah, I think that's a valid point. I think, yeah, it is probably mostly coming from the intersection. So these are, maybe I think a more accurate way to describe it is like, this is the view, yeah, according to alpha zero. So if we find concepts, they're new according to alpha zero, as if that makes sense.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then I just have a technical question about like how you actually like what the actual metric for like easier to reconstruct was. So you have these, you have all these vectors that correspond to board states. You put them in a matrix. You have one for the human and one for the alpha zero games, and then you take the spectral decomposition of both of them, or like exactly what are you doing?
Yeah. So basically, like if we take alpha zero's games, we have like the boards versus like the latent dimension, and then we take the spectral decomposition. And so we have a set of basis vectors for alpha zero's games. Then we do the exact same for human games. And then we have our concept vector, and we look at the reconstruction error if we try to reproduce it using the basis vectors of alpha zero. And the same with like the basis vectors found from human games. I don't have the equation, sorry, on the slide. It is in the paper.
Okay.
But what we... There is one thing we have to think about, which is that the rank of the matrices are different. So we select a number of positions that's much larger than the latent dimension, but the ranks of these spaces are just inherently different. And so what we'll do is we'll look sort of across, like, let's say, we look at the reconstruction error for if we take, let's say, 10 basis vectors, 20 basis vectors, 30 basis vectors, and then we compare those. And it has to always be strictly better reconstructed using alpha zeros than humans.
Thanks.
Any more question? Thank you for your question. Okay, and I will continue. So that was a novelty metric. We also introduced a second metric, which is whether or not these concepts are teachable. So the idea is quite simple. It's basically a concept is something that is used to solve a task, or that's something that we assume. And so can we teach this concept to another agent, and can that agent apply the concept to solve the task? So we do this in the following steps. So first we find a set of concept prototypes. So this is a set of chess positions that epitomize the concept. So basically playing the optimal move in this position requires applying the concept. And then we have to find a teacher, but given that we found, you know, our concepts in alpha zero, we set alpha zero to be the teacher. We also select a student. So this is an agent that doesn't know the concept yet. And essentially what we'll do is we'll just take an earlier checkpoint because we need an agent that can roughly play chess, but just can't apply this concept yet. And so what we'll do is we'll check whether or not the agent can make the correct moves in the position, which require applying the concept. And then what we do is we teach a student the concept by knowledge distillation. So essentially what we do is on the set of prototypes that we've constructed, we minimize the kill divergence between the teacher's policy and the student's policy. And then we evaluate whether or not the student has actually learned the concept by seeing whether or not they can accurately or correctly find the best moves on a set of unseen positions. So this is sort of kind of what the metric ends up looking like. So this is an example of a concept that we did select in the end, where the student improves more when it's trained on the concept prototypes than when trained on randomly selected positions. So there's a lot of lines. Basically, you can kind of ignore the title that just says which layer the concept was found in. But here, the blue lines basically show when the agent was trained on concept prototypes and then evaluated on concept prototypes, this dark blue line. So this answers the question, does it get better at playing positions which contain the concept? And then the green line shows when it was trained on concept prototypes and then evaluated on randomly sampled positions. So this checks whether or not it got better at playing chess more generally. And the reason that we care about that is we don't want it to get better just at the concept, but then forget how to do other things. And we benchmark our agent because you could also say like, okay, this agent was trained, you know, through knowledge distillation with like a stronger model. And so it's always going to learn to play chess better. And so we train a second agent, which has the same starting level, but then is trained on randomly sampled positions, and we see how it does. And these are sort of the letter lines that you see at the bottom. And so what we find overall is that the student improves more when it's trained on the concept data, both in applying the concept and playing more generally. And you can see this by kind of the gap between the darker lines and the letter lines. And we also find that actually the student is able to learn quite efficiently. So we didn't tune this experiment very much, but over the course of like 50 epochs, you can see that the performance gain is roughly the same as, you know, the model would have learned during self-play, taking around 80,000 to 100,000 steps.
Is each of these graphs a single concept? Like this, yes. This is an example of a single concept. I see. So the point of this is not every concept behaves like this. Like, are some concepts not teachable and then you would discard them?
Yes. And so what this also requires is that the concepts, because you have an evaluate, like you have to be able to apply the concept in other scenarios. This does eliminate concepts which are only unique to one position. And so we want to find concepts that, you know, are, you can think of them also kind of like as strategies that can be more generally applied, and is something that like you can actually learn and that is useful for another agent, which is sort of what this filters out.
I see, because your teaching procedures has like this danger of overfitting. Like you're really only selecting this very tiny data set of positions where you know this concept is decisive, and you're just training, you're just doing gradient descent on that set of decisions, right? Or do you mix in other generic positions or anything in the training?
No, so we only, it's a very short sort of training procedure. So we only train on those concepts, but we know that it doesn't overfit because you see this improvement on sort of general positions too.
Right. This is your test for this is your test for overfitting, basically. This is your thing here. So it's kind of amazing that there are any concepts like this at all because of your training procedure, right? I mean, like if a student came to me and I said, oh, I'm going to train like this, I would tell him, don't even try. It's just going to overfit. Nothing's going to work. But you sort of found a bunch of things that worked this way. How do you have a sense for like what percentage were teachable?
No, so it is in the paper, but I am going to be honest, I forgot.
Okay, we'll look it up.
But it is a very low percentage. It's very like I want to say it was less than 5%, but I could be off.
Very interesting.
I'll continue them. Or are there other questions actually?
I have some questions to make sure I'm on the same page. So are you labeling the concept by any chance or no?
No. So the labels here, like, do you mean, are we labeling them when we teach the student the concepts, or do you mean?
In general, when you discover a concept, because you, sometimes when you're explaining a concept, you explain it as, like the space strategy, like how much space it's taking. Are you labeling like these discovered concepts in such a way, or are you leaving them to be like just unsupervised discovered concepts?
Yeah. So we're not labeling them in general. What we do is for every concept, we end up with like a set of examples that contains a concept where like the optimal play requires applying the concept. And then as humans, what we could do is we could look at them and try to find sort of what the common threads are. But it is very difficult to do so. So like these concepts are extremely difficult because they were learned at the end of training. And so they're honestly a little bit beyond my level. And so that's like one thing that makes it very difficult to label. And I think the second thing that also makes it difficult to label is, maybe it's a little more of like a philosophical point, but like whenever you're trying to describe them, you either have to say, oh, sorry?
No, go ahead.
You either have to like come up with new words for these concepts, but that wouldn't really help in explaining it, or you have to explain them using sort of the language that we already have. And whenever we do the second thing, it sort of feels like you're simplifying it to, because you're constrained to the words that we have. And so then it always sounds like a recombination of existing concepts.
And since like the discovery has a constraint of being usable, and I feel like easier way to put that is if this concept improves in a better policy, right? So I guess that's how you're evaluating this, like on the y-axis on the graphs here is student teacher policy agreement. Is that like, is it just better at, like, does it just have a better policy, or what is that y-axis?
Yeah, no, I think that that's like kind of a valid way of summarizing it. Because like we said, like in the beginning, our definition was like a concept is something that it's useful. And so like we assume that concepts are useful for a downstream task. And so in that sense, you could also argue that that's just saying it has a better policy.
So what is the y-axis here though? Like what is student-teacher agreement, policy agreement? Is it cosine similarity?
No, so it's whether or not they select the same move in the position.
Oh, I see. Makes sense.
Thank you for asking. I do see we're at 5 minutes. So I think I will very briefly summarize.
We have a little time to go over. I don't know if you, I know that you might have to run, but if you have a little free time after, we do have a little time to go over.
Okay. No, I'm happy to go over a bit. So the part that I still have to talk about is a little bit like the human experiment, and then also the conclusion, which I think would take somewhere around 5 to 10 minutes. Do we have enough time for that?
Yeah, plenty of time.
Cool. All right. Well, then the next part is the human experiments, but maybe as a summary. So basically we had sort of this first version of the method, which, you know, found concepts that were useful. They were minimal. And then we also added two other aspects that we care about, which is that they're novel and that they're teachable. But the ultimate goal is actually like, okay, we found these concepts. Are they concepts or ideas that we can teach to humans? And so we looked into whether or not we could teach chess grandmasters new concepts. And we were extremely lucky, actually, because we got to play with, or sorry, we got to work with four brilliant players. Vladimir Kramnik, Liu Kashdi, Hu Yifeng, and Maxime Vachier-Legras. And they all happen to hold actually a world championship title, which is insane. And Gukesh is currently actually one of the world champion contenders. And so the setup was sort of as follows. It had like three different stages. And the way that I like to think about it is actually like, you know, when you were in high school and you were trying to solve a math problem or like learn how to like learn a new sort of method. The way that I would go about it is like, you know, for like taking derivatives, for example, I would go to the textbook, I'd try to solve a couple of problems, wouldn't always know how to solve it. And then I'd go to the back of the book and I'd check the solution and see like what I should have done. And then kind of distill from that, like, okay, like, what should I do next time? And then I'd go back and like see whether or not I understood it. And the procedure here is actually very similar. So by the way, chess players, very often they train by trying to solve puzzles. So what we did is we had for each concept a set of puzzles that correspond to that concept. First, we want to see whether or not, you know, they could accurately solve these puzzles. So we got a baseline performance. Then after that, what we did is we provided them with alpha zeros calculations. So this is kind of like the solutions in the back. And we gave them some time to think about it and see, you know, what also alpha zero would have played in these positions. And then the third stage was that we gave them a new set of puzzles corresponding to the same concepts. And then the same sort of concepts that were shown in stage one. And then we saw whether or not they got better. And so this is...
Yeah, I have a question. How did you find puzzles that correspond to concepts?
Yep. So basically what we did is using sort of cosine similarity. So in the beginning, we had this assumption that the more relevant a concept is for a position, the smaller the cosine similarity. And then what we did is we just going to go back to the formulation. Basically, we searched for positions where these constraints would hold. So if you look at like we would, you know, find a position, and then we would check, okay, in the optimal rollout, is this concept more relevant for the optimal rollout than it is for a suboptimal rollout? And we also did some filter checks sort of for the quality of the position, which is detailed in the paper.
And how many puzzles did you give the experts to look at?
Yeah, so we, I think, so we gave them each between 36 and 48 in total. We would have wanted to do more, to be honest, but given that they are very strong and professional chess players, we had sort of a constrained amount of time with them.
Cool.
Are there more questions?
So thank you so much for your presentation. It was great. Also, the whole work is amazing. I really enjoyed reading the paper. But the question that I had, like, when I read this part of the paper, I was like, okay, but how would this compare to just the Grandmaster's play against AlphaGo? Do you have, like, any...
Wait, so do you mean specifically if they would play against AlphaZero, or like their play versus AlphaZero's play?
Let's you lock them into a room for 10 hours to study these puzzles.
Mm-hmm.
What would happen to their puzzle performance if they just played against AlphaZero for 10 hours?
Just generically.
Ooh.
Yeah.
Yeah, that would be interesting. And I think that would be really fun to explore. In short, I don't know. I think that would have been, very interesting. I think the difference, though, is maybe when you ask them to play one full game, there's some bias in which positions they select, right? And which they'll go into, they can define it. Whereas here, I think you have a shorter experiment overall because the game takes quite long, and you select the position. So it tends to be more, I guess, informed by AlphaZero. Maybe a weird way of,
sorry. I think maybe you would even outperform this baseline, but it would be just so cool if we could run this baseline.
Or a different suggestion would have been, when you evaluate, the ideal would have been to choose the same to choose four concepts, two of which were the same as the ones in the puzzle, and two of which were different concepts that were orthogonal to the others, and then you could see if there's a gap in the Grandmaster's ability to get better at solving puzzles in the concepts that they've seen.
Yeah, that is actually one of my biggest regrets in the setup, because I would go back and do that, to be honest.
I see.
I think we didn't do it because we wanted to sort of maximize, we didn't know whether these concepts were teachable, and so we want to show them as many as possible and check which ones are teachable. But I think from a learning perspective, the setup that you're describing would have been so much better. And we had we did a little pilot pre-study, just to sort of see whether the setup made sense or not. And we had someone, also a very strong player, and they got a different concept in the beginning and the last stage, and we didn't see any improvement. But that was just based off of one concept. So we don't know whether
Could you repeat what the pilot study did? Your audio cut out.
Oh, sorry about that. Can you hear me now again?
Yes.
Okay. In the pilot study, so we tried to see whether or not the setup made sense and get any kinks out of the experiment. But one of the things that we did have is one participant got a different concept in the first phase and the third phase. And there we didn't see any improvement.
So you did have this experiment in pilot. That's cool.
Yes.
So did all of the participants get the same concepts and you're looking at agreement, or did they all get different concepts?
So we gave them different concepts. I think both would have been interesting to do. I think it was just our worry was what if we give them, a concept that's not teachable? So we were just trying to maximize the number of different concepts seen by Grandmasters.
Did you find that all four concepts were learnable by the Grandmasters?
Not all concepts were. So I think this isn't in the paper, but will come out hopefully in the next version. But we performed this analysis, and I think out of the concepts that they saw the majority were learnable, but there was a small percentage, like I think two or so, that weren't. But we will, I think we're going to add that in the next version of the paper. The breakdown that we did have in the original paper was whether or not they improved in general, which we did see per Grandmaster. I also had an example, but I will maybe skip over it given the time. But this is in the paper. But maybe just to conclude the work. So in our paper, essentially what we tried to do is we found an unsupervised framework for finding new concepts that were minimal, useful, novel, and teachable. And then we showed that in the supervised setting, the concepts that we found are data efficient and can also be used to find new concept prototypes and influence model behavior. And then we also provided evidence that we can teach these concepts to top grandmasters. My personal takeaways from the paper is one of the things that it kind of, I had to think about is that it made me think about the way that we interact with AI systems. So if you think about a lot of the AI systems, so whether it's like chess engines or LLMs, we often query these systems with prompts or chess positions. So we're asking them specific questions. And in this work, what we try to do is, you know, AlphaZero essentially gives us positions that it thinks is conceptually important. And this kind of removes, at least to a certain degree, the bias of like only asking questions that we can think about as a chess player. I think my key takeaway is that you can really see that AlphaZero has a different prior over what concepts are relevant in a given position. So as humans, you know, in a lot of different aspects of life, we already have sort of these prior over which concepts are important or the way that we're supposed to interact or make certain decisions. But because AlphaZero, you know, learned through self-play, it has come up with a completely different prior over what's important in certain situations. There are also some things that made it difficult for humans to learn from AlphaZero. And I think one of the main ones was that there's this difference in objectives. So humans, for example, we play competitive chess. We will sometimes make slightly irrational decisions. So for example, we'll take a slightly worse position if there's a chance that we can win, as long as the risk is very small. Whereas AlphaZero just tries to play optimally and it assumes an optimal opponent as well. There's supposed to be a slide after this, but it's not. Oh, yeah. So the future directions that I am excited about. So I like this project a lot because I thought it was really fun. It was very interesting to work on. But at the end of the day, chess is a sort of toy domain where we can develop methods and verify them more easily. But, you know, ideally, we would do this in other fields like medicine. I think another aspect that I'm very interested in is sort of leveraging these interactions between humans and AI systems. So you already see this in LLMs where, for example, debate can be used to improve factuality and improve reasoning. But I think another thing that would be very interesting is sort of to have interactive explanations. So a lot of interpretability methods are zero shot in the sense of like, you know, we have a prediction and we provide an explanation. But here, for example, I think our grandmasters would have benefited a lot from being able to interact with the system and actually query like, okay, you know, my solution wasn't the same as the solution of AlphaZero, but like what was wrong with mine? And so like having these explanations for why other decisions are incorrect is very useful for humans. And this also is another context. So for example, clinicians, we find there in our medical work that when you have a model and it provides an explanation and it doesn't use a feature that clinicians often use, they just immediately lose trust. And so having this ability for clinicians to also sort of give feedback to the model of an explanation that's then used by the model, or at least sort of interact with models about explanations, is something that's very useful. And the last direction that I'm also very excited about is this sort of enhancing and blocking model capabilities. I think people talk a lot about enhancing capabilities and also blocking in the context of AI safety, but I think that blocking model capabilities more generally is something that can be leveraged in an interesting way. So think, for example, about the context of solving a chess puzzle or theorem proving, What we'll do with humans is we'll usually try one approach. When it doesn't work, we get negative feedback on why that approach didn't work, but we use that sort of negative explanation to then say like, okay, we're going to try a different approach, right? So like if we want to do proof by enumeration, it doesn't work, then we might try to, you know, write like an inductive proof. And if that doesn't work, we'll try a different proof style. In the same way, for example, with chess, we might try one approach or one idea, but once we know that that idea doesn't work, we block sort of, we don't consider it again. We don't keep repeating that. And I'm curious about whether or not we can sort of apply those ideas in other contexts to improve model performance, which is also related to this project, because basically with like, with a chess human, or in the context of chess, like humans also like sometimes, you know, we try something and once we've tried it, we block it. But we, in AlphaZero, you can see that it very often retries the same idea. So anyways, thank you so much for listening. And I'm happy to take any more questions.
So I'm really curious about your idea of knowledge discovery, like different models from AlphaZero. Do you have any sort of vision for that, of how this method or similar method would be applied in LLMs?
Yeah, I think that there's like some components that can transfer or not. So I think like the part about the spectral decomposition is something that you could also try in LLMs. I mean, in LLMs, you also have like other avenues, for example, like in the context of like sparse autoencoders, you have like, you know, the features you can label and the features that you can't label, which is maybe a very direct approach. I do think, so maybe this context of like teachability is a little bit more complicated in LLMs. But yeah,
I guess like my key question there is, how do we deal with this M versus H, right? Specifically for LLMs, like, do we just limit our kind of like set of concepts that we would discover in LLM to a certain domain?
You could do that. I think in the context of LLMs, I've been thinking about it, and there's a lot of different ways to do this. But for example, if you think about it across different languages, is maybe like a way to do it. And then you might, for example, one idea that I'm very specifically, I've been thinking about for a while is like lacunae. So those are words that exist in one language or not in another. And so you have this sort of concept that exists in one language and not another, and whether or not you can use that to identify patterns to find new concepts as like a starting point.
That's interesting.
Yeah,
because I guess the difference is that with LLMs, they're like essentially trained on the human distribution. Whereas with AlphaZero is explicitly trained not on the human distribution. But yeah, so I guess you would have to find some factorization, like different languages or something like that, where like one group of humans wouldn't know it and another would.
Yeah. Although you could maybe be like, I don't know, in LLMs I've played around with them and I've asked it to come up with new words and it will. So maybe you can just get it to self-generate a data set of like new words and then see what happens.
But also just because it was trained on the human distribution doesn't pick up the same concepts, right? I mean, that is kind of a strong assumption.
That is true, yeah.
I guess like another question is also, so let's say we do find those like sort of different concepts even with synthetically generated words, but then the question is like, what is the objective we are sort of like measuring this concept against? Because like here you have a very specific objective, which is like winning the game, right? But what do we do with the LLM there? Like that's kind of why I suggested maybe limiting to a certain domain.
Yeah, no, I think that's a great point. And I think that's also why we kind of focus on like usefulness of concepts, right? So like they are sort of useful in a task. And I think like with, for example, language, what you would have is like, if you can have more efficient communication is like a weird proxy maybe, or like,
That's interesting.
If, I don't know, like for example, if that word can be used to solve or describe something or based off of like, I don't know, like I think like language is like information communication, right? And so like, if I can create a word and based off of that word, you can then use that to solve the task correctly, which you could have only inferred if we had the same sort of view of what that word means. Something
like that. That's really cool. Yeah. So like unique sort of dense descriptor of something. Yeah.
Yeah. No, I think language is a really interesting domain. Chris?
A question that I had, like, did you think about applying your approach to other superhuman AI systems like AlphaFold or something like that, where the domain is not as interpretable as like chessboards?
Yeah, no, I think that would have been really cool. I think the hard part is like the verification at the end, but I think that that would be something that's very interesting to do.
I guess all the way until the superhuman part is kind of directly, your approach would be more or less directly applicable, like as long as you stay with the data sets, I guess, and like properties that are captured by data sets. But then the next step, but there you needed the grandmasters anyways as well. Like, so the teaching to weaker versions would be still applicable. Filtering would be still applicable.
Yeah.
But just like the final presentation to the grandmasters might have to look different.
Yeah, I think that'd be really cool. I think you're right. I think up until that stage, it could be, the methodology could be transferred.
So you have one difference, right, which is the part of your presentation you sort of flew through where you had a supervised sanity check of your method. So you have this unsupervised method, and then you actually sort of checked it on supervised data, which is very interesting, right? So like, in other words, you verified that the concepts that it was finding, you know, that it was discovering a lot of concepts that you could have found supervised. Is that right? That were previously labeled by humans.
Yes.
Yeah. And I wonder if that would be so both in language, we've talked about language and something like AlphaFold. I feel like even in language, it's been studied for so many years. Like, I have this sneaking suspicion that the number of concepts in language that we've labeled is this vanishingly small amount of the actual concepts that are needed to, you know, construct, you know, fluent language. And the sanity check might not even work very well. Right. So it's an assertion of mine. I don't know if you feel like that's probably true or.
Sorry, I think you broke up at the end.
Sorry, we're having a bad connection. So when you did the sanity check for chess, you were checking with a lot of existing chess concepts, and did you have to have a large set of chess concepts to do this check, or was it a small book?
I mean, so we checked it in a couple of different scenarios. I think it's like, I guess
it's our audio, our connection is quite bad. Let's see, what can we do?
Like, it's
good on my end. Oh, should I, maybe I'll switch the room audio. Well, give me a second here. I'm gonna switch audio here. Okay, so try again. This is a different audio thing. So can you say what is it that you did for the sanity check?
Yeah. So I think for our sanity check, we try to test it in different scenarios, just because at the end of the day, we were sort of trying to understand whether or not our method functioned as we expected it to function, and kind of. I think so. We did it. I've forgotten how many concepts, and so we did it, like, I think on like 5 different types of concepts in the end. But yeah, I think you could always go further and further with that. So I think this is maybe not the most scientific answer, but like, I think we try to like test it sufficiently well to know that like our method works as expected. But in terms of the number of concepts, like, I think more is always better. So it's hard to say exactly when to stop.
Okay.
Sorry, I don't know if that's a what you were asking.
I'm more or less asking, is this something where chess is unique because so many things are given names and labeled in chess as certain types of things to look for, whereas even in language, or particularly in things like AlphaFold, maybe the important concepts are not as well labeled or as well organized. And so you might not even know how to do the sanity check.
Yeah, I think it definitely gets harder in other domains, but I do think we have enough in language, for example, right? Like you could think about concepts in language as like a lot of different things. Like you could have like just part of speech as one, you could have like the different types of tasks and sort of the strategy or like techniques, or I don't know how you'd describe it in language, but like, you know, in translation, the ability to translate as like a sort of concept is also things you could analyze. And so I think, I feel like in language, it should be okay. And also like in protein folding, so I know very little about this, but I could imagine that there's like certain things that are well known and you could check whether or not like your method works as expected on those things. But that does require, I'm guessing, more domain knowledge there, unless those data sets already exist.
Great.
Are there any other questions?
Yeah. Have you have you showed this to the, you know, to the chess community very much, and has there been sort of like a reaction within the chess community to this work? Or do they?
Yeah. So I think we shared a little bit. It is under review, and so we're trying to be careful with avoiding. I don't know. We didn't want to. I think you have to be careful a little bit, like when it's submitted to a journal, with like not publishing articles about it elsewhere, or like talking about it elsewhere. I'm not exactly sure what the exact regulations are, so we've sort of not gone too much into that yet. But from the people who have read it and seen it, they were actually very positive. I think that like most of them found the concepts very interesting. I think though one of the things that we would have loved to do, given more time, is also, you know, we found concepts that were learned by AlphaZero at the end of training. Those are extremely difficult concepts by nature and by construction. And so it would have been really cool to see what concepts we could have found at different periods of training as well, like earlier on. And so the ones that maybe like, you know, like amateur players could have learned, or like that are like closer to human level.
I wonder if you look at the checkpoints that overlapped with people's ELO, like their particular ELO, if you extracted concepts from those checkpoints, whether they would learn better, right? Like if you moved in a window along like model checkpoints, and you did this for every window, you know, would people's learning, you know, get better at their own ELO level?
Yeah, no, I think that's something that we would have loved to do, like kind of like create this like AlphaZero chess curriculum and see how it would have done. That would have been super cool. Yeah.
Well, thank you so much, Lisa, for spending so much time with us today. It was really enjoyable, and I think we learned a lot. I think thanks a lot.
Thank you all so much for coming and having me, and all for all the great questions. I really enjoyed it.
That's great. Lisa, I'm going to ask a greedy question. Do you have a couple minutes to just chat with me afterwards?
Yeah, sure.
Okay, great. I'll send you another Zoom link over email. And a couple minutes. Great.
Thank you. Bye.